Today is Monday, March 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, how to stop the COVID-19 coronavirus.
We are not helpless bystanders in the face of this outbreak. We have a lot of things in the toolbox to try to reduce and mitigate the impact, even if we are not able to contain it completely.
Plus, tensions on the Syria-Turkey border, and tomorrow may be a decisive day for who will run against U.S. President Donald Trump. Those stories and more are next. Our top story today, the rapid spread of the new coronavirus, known as COVID-19, is prompting governments to step up control measures. As of Monday, there have been over 89,000 cases of the virus globally, the majority in China. Outside of China, it has spread to 66 other countries with more than 8,800 cases and 130 deaths. Globally, the illness has killed over 3,000 people. In total, mainland China had 202 new confirmed cases of COVID-19 infections on Sunday, but infections there have been dropping. Meanwhile, Andorra, Armenia, Czech Republic, Dominican Republic, Iceland, and Indonesia have all confirmed their first cases. South Korea postponed the start of all schools by 2 weeks as 599 new cases were reported Monday, taking the national tally to 4,335, while the death toll rose to 26. Iran's death toll reached 54 on Sunday. That's the highest outside China. Iran's number of infections have rose to 978. A member of a council that advises Iran's supreme leader died Monday after falling sick from the COVID-19 virus. That's according to state radio. Washington State in the United States on Sunday confirmed the second coronavirus death in the U.S., where the number of infections has gone past 75. There are also infections in New York and Florida. France, meanwhile, confirmed its cases rose to 130 on Sunday, up from 100 a day earlier. Britain announced 13 new infections, taking its total to 36. There are also new cases in Ecuador. The outbreak in northern Italy has so overwhelmed the public health system there that officials are taking extraordinary measures to care for the sick, seeking to bring doctors out of retirement and accelerate graduation dates for nursing students. The region of Lombardy in particular has been the epicenter of Italy's outbreak, registering the first positive test and now counting 984 of Italy's 1,600 cases. To find out more about what can be done to stop the spread of COVID-19, earlier today I spoke with Dr. Saad Omer, the director of the Institute for Global Health at Yale University in Connecticut. Dr. Omer explains what China has done well so far to get the number of new cases to drop there and what the rest of the world can do too. Here's what he had to say.
I think it's too premature to say that the outbreak's impact is over in China, but there are some good signs. Things are leveling off, and some of the new cases are appearing at a lower rate in China and in different parts of China, including at the epicenter of this outbreak. My best guess is that the aggressive approach to controlling, irrespective of some of the other issues, obviously a response should not just be effective, it should be humane as well. But looking at just the effectiveness of the response, I think that may have played a role in these more recent trends. However, too early to say definitively, but I think it's reasonable to say that their measures for social distancing, having an upsurge in testing capacity, which is extremely important, adding more capacity to treat patients who were sick, some contact tracing, meaning looking at people who came into contact with the cases that they were identifying, seem to have worked, at least for now. That's a tentative assessment.
You know, looking at the spread of the virus right now, it appears to be spreading much quicker. You know, we're seeing in the Middle East a huge increase in the numbers there, also in Europe, particularly Italy. In North America, in the U.S., we've seen a big spike in cases that are now not only in one state of Washington, but now it looks like they're in New York. There's been a lot of new cases there in Florida. I mean, what's behind this seemingly quite rapid growth, almost everywhere?
So there was some really early work that said that just because of the travel patterns and just because of how things are in an interconnected world, a significant proportion of cases were missed in the early parts of the outbreak in China. Even if you have the best surveillance system, the outbreak was already out there, and because of the lag in, you know, the incubation period and the lag in the appearance of symptoms, especially in large numbers, there was a lot of undetected circulation going on. So a lot of these cases didn't get tested. And now that we have expanded some of that capacity and are in the process of expanding it more, we seem to be finding a lot of these cases. A lot of this is expected because outbreaks have this slow rise period, and then they approach this exponential phase where you start seeing a sharp increase. That exponential phase doesn't go infinitely. It's time bound. And so eventually we will be able to either control it or there will be a natural plateau.
Looking globally as this sharp increase happens, is there anything that can be done right now to try to quicken the leveling off of this rise?
Yeah, so there are a couple of things. First, in terms of the outbreak control and infection control as well, from a public health perspective, early isolation and early contact tracing is likely to have an impact. So the idea is that you identify your cases early, look at their contacts, implement voluntary isolation, and when needed, quarantine, so that quarantine is for asymptomatic people and isolation is for those who have the symptoms or have the disease. And so you implement these measures. At the personal level, people need to be cognizant of the recommendations. One of this is to get the flu vaccine so that you don't clog up the system by presenting with respiratory illness in ERs and urgent care facilities or your primary care docs. The other thing is looking at hand washing as an approach. It is an evidence-based approach. It's not going to take care of all of this problem, but it certainly definitely helps at the individual level. And doing it properly and doing it repeatedly is helpful, because a lot of this transmission actually happens, even though it's a respiratory virus, a lot of the transmission happens when this virus settles on different surfaces and you touch the surface. We are not helpless bystanders in the face of this outbreak, but we have a lot of things in the toolbox as the public health community to try to reduce and mitigate the impact, even if we are not able to contain it completely from going into new countries.
That was Dr. Saad Omer, director of the Yale Institute for Global Health in Connecticut. Now, Europe is the hardest hit continent outside Asia, which is where the virus started. To find out how Europe is responding, I spoke earlier today to journalist Nicolas Pinault in Paris, France.
Yes, the president of the European Commission said today that the European Union's Disease Prevention Agency had raised the bloc's risk level to high as the coronavirus continues to spread. Ursula von der Leyen told that in a news conference in Brussels after the agency had raised its risk level up from moderate, with more than 2,100 cases of coronavirus confirmed in 18 of the 27 EU states. EU Health Commissioner Stella Kyriakides confirmed today 38 EU citizens had died as a result of the flu-like virus.
And then in France, it looks like on Sunday there was an increase of 30 cases in just one day. And then also it seems like the outbreak is actually coming closer to Paris. Before it was more in the Alps region, and now it's moving closer to the capital. Can you talk a bit about how France is reacting and what's the latest there?
Yes, in France, you have more and more cases every day. And the French president, Emmanuel Macron, today canceled all his trips non-related to coronavirus. He wants to be focused only on the epidemic. So he only going to travel and meet in hospitals or deal with healthcare workers to see what's going on in the country. And let's talk about how the French authorities are dealing with that. For example, you have many closures within Paris. For example, the Louvre has been closed for the past 2 days. Staff voted in a meeting to exercise their legal right not to work due to this threat. And so far, it might happen the same in the Versailles Castle. They're going to have a meeting this Tuesday to maybe take the same measures. You have a lot of quarantines in France ongoing. School trips have been canceled by decision by the French authorities. And you have also many schools in the clusters where the epidemic has been spreading, where the virus has been spreading, that has been closed in different parts of France. As of this Monday morning, we still have 130 cases confirmed. It's going to be bigger. Usually French authorities, they have the daily meeting overnight to assess the current situation.
Last of all, Italy is really where the outbreak is at its worst in Europe. There's over 1,000 cases there already, and now it seems that there's a shortage of health workers, so they're trying to pull some doctors out of retirement to help deal with the outbreak. Can you give us the latest on what's happening in Italy?
Yes, this week in Italy, it's going to be a turning point, according to the head of the National Institute, Silvio Brusafero. That's what he said in an Italian newspaper. If the infections drop within the next 7 days, it means that the closures and measures taken have worked. But so far, it's very concerning in Italy. As of Sunday, the country has 500 new cases. It's the biggest jump since the beginning of the epidemic. And they're trying to do everything to stop the virus from spreading. Right now, Italy is the number one country for the number of cases of coronavirus, and everything has been concerned. The economic activity has been reduced because of the virus, and the economy minister, Roberto Gualtieri, announced yesterday that the government is going to put $3.5 billion to help the economy.
That was journalist Nicolas Pinault in Paris. A dramatic standoff at a shopping mall in the Philippine capital ended with one person wounded Monday. Authorities said a disgruntled former security guard opened fire with a pistol at Manila's V Mall before rushing to the second floor and taking at least 60 hostages. After an hours-long standoff, the suspect walked out of the shopping center with his hostages and was allowed to speak before reporters for several minutes to express his grievances against his superiors before police approached and subdued him. Israelis vote Monday in the country's unprecedented third election in less than a year to decide whether right-wing Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu stays in power despite his coming criminal trial on corruption charges. Netanyahu, the longest-serving leader in Israeli history, has been the caretaker prime minister for more than a year as a divided Israel has weathered two inconclusive elections and prolonged political paralysis. And after decades of controversy, the Catholic Church will open its archives Monday for historians to review documents related to Pope Pius XII's actions during World War II, when the German Nazi Party organized the murder of 6 million Jews in Europe in a genocide now known as the Holocaust. Pope Pius XII, who led the Catholic Church from 1939 until his death in 1958, never spoke out against the Holocaust. The Pope's decision to stay silent during the slaughter has prompted decades of controversy and debate. More than 200 researchers applied for permission to access the Vatican's archives to review millions of documents the Church had kept locked up. This is VOA News. Tomorrow is Super Tuesday, when Democratic Party voters in 14 U.S. states will choose their candidate to run against President Donald Trump this November. It's one of the most important days of primary voting of the year and comes after former Vice President Joe Biden won decisively in the state of South Carolina, his first primary victory so far. Also, Pete Buttigieg, the former mayor of a town in the state of Indiana, dropped out of the race to become the Democrats' presidential candidate, and there's been plenty of other political action in the U.S. VOA political analyst Jim Malone joins us in the studio to discuss what's coming. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Hi, Jason.
So can you first explain for our listeners, what is Super Tuesday?
Well, we've had four states vote so far. They've been spread around the country. Super Tuesday, 14 state primaries on one day, and they are representing all regions of the country, South, West, Northeast, Midwest. So it's really the closest thing we have to a national primary. And, of course, the most important thing is that there's more than 1,300 delegates at stake. Don't forget, that's how we get to presidential nominees. They go to a convention. They have to get a certain number of nominees to become the nominee, or sorry, delegates. And that's what they're hunting for now in terms of Democratic delegates.
Now let's look at some of the candidates. So far, the front runner in the race is Bernie Sanders, the senator from Vermont. he's been leading so far. Can he clinch a nomination tomorrow?
Well, I would say if he were to sweep the field and, you know, deliver Joe Biden a real hammer blow like that, he would certainly be on his way and it would look dim for Biden. But Biden had a huge victory on Saturday in South Carolina. It could be a sort of game changer for the whole Democratic battle. And if Biden can use the momentum coming out of the South Carolina victory to do well in a number of states on Super Tuesday, he can cut into Sanders' lead in the delegates. Sanders is favored to do well in the And two of the largest states voting on Tuesday, California and Texas, those two states alone have more than 600 delegates at stake. But if Biden can close the gap in those states and also defeat Sanders in some other states, primarily southern states like Alabama, Tennessee, places like that, then Biden can make a real race of it and keep that delegate margin close.
Now, looking at Biden and his victory in South Carolina over the weekend, that was his first victory so far, and he won in part because of a lot of support from black voters in South Carolina. At the same time, Pete Buttigieg, the former mayor of Gary, Indiana, he just dropped out of the race, and part of that is because his lack of support among black voters. Can you explain a bit about this?
Yeah, the Democratic Party is the more diverse party. There's no doubt about it. And African-American voters and Latino voters and now increasingly Asian-American voters all make up core constituencies. But there's no bigger one than African-American voters. If you cannot find a way to appeal to them, you're probably not going to get very far. And that's exactly the wall that Pete Buttigieg ran up against. And now the question is, what will happen to his supporters? There's some thinking it could help Joe Biden down the line. Biden is relying on those African-American voters to come out and give him an edge over Sanders. And we'll be looking at some of the southern states on Tuesday with large African-American populations to see how well Biden does.
One last question. Some of the other candidates like Elizabeth Warren, how might they perform? What are they looking to achieve tomorrow?
They're under pressure, and I include Amy Klobuchar in that group. They need to show some substantial, if not victories, then good showings in a number of states. Otherwise, they're going to come under increasing pressure to leave the race.
That's VOA political analyst Jim Malone here in the studio. Thanks for joining us, Jim.
You bet.
Syrian government forces entered parts of a strategic rebel-held town on Monday, and Turkey said it would keep hitting President Bashar al-Assad's troops after ramping up operations in its biggest intervention yet in the Syrian civil war. A Syrian state television correspondent in the town of Sarakeb said the army was combing the town after the retreat of Turkey-backed rebels. Rebel sources said clashes were continuing in western parts of the town. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said rebels were trying to regain control. Sarakeb has already changed hands twice in less than a month, reflecting its importance as a gateway to the government-controlled northern city of Aleppo and to rebel-held Idlib city to the west. Fighting has escalated dramatically in recent days in northwest Syria, where Turkey had sent thousands of troops and military vehicles to counter Syrian government forces' advances. Now, amid all this fighting, Turkey and Russia have come closer than ever to direct confrontation in Syria. The two countries traded threats over airspace after Turkish forces shot down two Syrian government warplanes and struck a military airport. The Turkish president demanded that Syria withdraw its troops from around Idlib, which is the last rebel holdout. Now, civilians are suffering amidst all this fighting. The fighting has displaced a million people since December near Turkey's southern border, causing what the United Nations says may be the worst humanitarian crisis in 9 years of war. Last week, Turkey, which itself hosts about a million refugees, said it would allow refugees to cross into Europe, despite a long-standing agreement with the European Union not to do so. Already, thousands of refugees have already attempted to cross into neighboring Greece and Bulgaria. VOA's Kate Pound Dawson spoke with journalist Dorian Jones in Istanbul about the latest developments.
Well, the Turkish military operation in Idlib appears to be further escalating. Turkish air forces using mainly drones have been pounding Syrian forces, convoys. On Sunday, they targeted a Syrian military airbase close to the main industrial city of Aleppo in Turkey's border. It was rendered inoperable. According to Ankara, two planes over the weekend, Syrian planes, were shot down. by Turkish forces. It's all part of this ongoing campaign, which was outlined by President Erdogan speaking Monday, where he said that this operation will continue to intensify. He also warned Turkey to expect to see what he referred to as more Turkish martyrs. But he said this is a battle as important as the National War of Liberation at the beginning of the 20th century. He's putting on that kind of level. So I think the message to Damascus and to Moscow and to the rest of the world is that Turkey is determined to drive the Syrian forces away from its border in Idlib, and in the words of Erdogan, to teach Damascus a lesson.
At the same time, we've been having flows of migrants from Turkey trying to leave and get into Europe. What's the situation there?
Well, again, we understand thousands more refugees in Turkey have been heading mainly towards the Greek border. This is ever since Turkey announced last week that it was ending its policy of preventing people from leaving Turkey to try and seek entry into Europe. We've had reports all day Monday of clashes with people trying to break through the Greek frontier. They've been pushed back with the Greek security forces using tear gas, stun grenades. And there has been one unconfirmed report of at least one death among those refugees trying to seek entry into Greece. Athens has been very determined. It says it's not going to allow anyone to enter its country illegally. But that pressure is expected to build on its frontier as thousands more people stream towards the Greek frontier. And Erdogan, speaking on Monday, was very clear. He said this policy will not change. He says that he is getting phone calls from European leaders. He expects to speak with the German chancellor on Monday evening, but his position is resolute. He says Turkey cannot deal with any more refugees in this country, and any refugee that wants to leave is more than welcome to do so. So there is this looming crisis developing with the European Union and Turkey, but Turkey has said all the promises that the Europeans have promised in support of the Turkey's 3.5 to 4 million refugees has not been delivered.
Now, is there any hope for some sort of negotiations to de-escalate this situation?
Well, President Erdogan is due to meet later this week with the Russian President Vladimir Putin, although the date hasn't been confirmed, but it is expected to be Thursday. And I think that is going to be a critical meeting if it goes ahead. If these two leaders do meet, there will be an expectation that they have to deliver on something. These two men have, in many ways, been the glue that has held this relationship between Turkey and Russia together over the last few years, even though they have very contradicting interests in the region. The two men have appears a good chemistry, that they have managed to manage those difficulties and differences. This is, in many ways, the ultimate test. It is expected that Turkey will continue to ramp up its military operations against Damascus. So when Erdogan does go to Moscow, he will be very much in a position of strength when he meets with Putin. That's very important for Ankara, but it is seen in many ways as a critical meeting if it does occur. It does offer a possibility of a way out of this escalating situation and possibly even some way to ending and bringing an end to the Syrian civil war.
That was journalist Dorian Jones in Istanbul speaking to VOA's Kate Pound Dawson. Chilean President Sebastian Piñera on Monday signed a law that strengthens existing legislation against femicide, expanding the definition to including the killing of non-married partners and boosting penalties for killing pregnant women and minors. Chile's current law against femicide includes penalties of between 15 years and life, but was restricted largely to the murder of live-in partners or spouses. The new law expands that definition and adds additional penalties for killing a pregnant woman, a minor, or a disabled woman. The so-called Gabriela's Law, named for Gabriela Alcaino, a young woman killed by her boyfriend, sends a, quote, potent signal without any ambiguity against any type of violence directed especially against women, Piñera said. Thus far in 2020, there have been 5 femicides committed in Chile and 17 attempted homicides of women, according to government statistics. That's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Nadia Taha, and our engineer, John Dryden, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Have a great day.